And our special guest tonight is Brother Guy Consolmagno. We're talking about the Vatican Observatory, several of his books, bestsellers, God's Mechanics, How Scientists and Engineers Make Sense of Religion, and Turn Left at Orion. You are going to hear one heck of a story next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Brother Guy Consolmagno is a planetary scientist, curator of meteorites at the Vatican Observatory. He has served as chair of the Division for Planetary Sciences of the American Astronomical Society, past president of Commission 16, that's Planets and Satellites of the International Astronomical Union, earning an undergraduate master's degree from MIT, PhD in planetary science from the University of Arizona, was a researcher at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics at MIT, taught university physics at Lafayette College before entering the Jesuits in 1989. Here he is back. It's been 3 years on Coast to Coast. Brother Guy, how are you?
Doing great. I can't believe it's been 3 years. Wow.
My gosh, it went by way too fast, but it's definitely good to have you back again. We got to do this at least once a year, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
God's Mechanics, the last time you were on, we talked about that, and I assume it's still doing well, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's out in paperback now, so you can, you know, pick it up a little bit cheaper, I guess.
And also, you've got the Turn Left at Orion, which is a great name.
Oh, I'm really excited about that. This is a book that a friend of mine, Dan Davis, and I first put together more than 20 years ago. It's just how to use a small telescope. You know, anyone who's got a pair of eyes and can go outside and enjoy the stars can enjoy them so much more if they know what they're looking for. So we put together this book 20 years ago, but telescopes have gotten so much better that we went and completely rewrote the book. So now people with the more modern telescopes can use it to find all sorts of cool things in the nighttime sky.
You know what? I've been told that now with computer software, all you have to do and GPS tracking and everything, push a button. If you want to look at Mars, you don't have to look around like we used to as kids. You just push a button and it finds it by itself. Is that true?
Well, yes and no. Those are a whole lot harder to set up than they'll tell you. The other thing is, half the fun of it is the looking around, you know.
It is.
You can go to the grocery store and buy a box of frozen fish. That's not the same thing as going fishing.
I remember leaving my catechism classes in Detroit, Brother Guy, going out in the cold Detroit winter, taking my telescope out, which was just a little refractor type,
yep,
and looking into the sky, and it was amazing. And when I first saw Saturn and those rings, or the moons of Jupiter, I was like a kid in a candy store. And I bet the same thing happened to you, didn't it?
Absolutely, of course. You know, we share this Detroit background. We also share, yep, both having one of these little telescopes. I got mine with trading stamps. Remember trading stamps?
Oh, yeah, sure do.
Do these things into a little book, you know, get your tongue all colored purple. And
they were S&H trading stamps, weren't they?
S&H and Gold Bell, and there are all these different,
yeah,
varieties, depending on which grocery store your mom went to.
But
the great thing was you could, you know, take one of these little telescopes out, and as you say, there are a couple of things that everybody knows to look at. What you and I didn't know was that there were dozens of double stars we could have seen just with a little telescope like that. And, you know, they still sell those telescopes today. You can get them for under $100, some of them under $50, and they're great fun to use.
Yeah, they sure are. And, you know, every kid should do that. My dad, Brother Guy, passed away last week. My mother was telling me a story while we were there, and she said, you remember that little telescope you had and how much you wanted it and everything? And we had to go to Dad to get him to buy it for you. And I said, yeah, I do. She said, let me tell you something. He was so enthused about buying that. When you said, I want a telescope, Dad, can you help me out here? He thought that was the greatest thing he has ever bought you.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, it touched my heart, but it had such a magical feel to it.
Yeah.
That's
another thing we share, that I learned my astronomy from my dad. It's a great thing that dads and kids can get together with.
Yeah, it sure is. It sure is indeed. Well, let's talk about some of the things that are going on in space, Brother Guy, and also the Vatican. I'm curious. The Vatican has how many observatories now? One in Arizona, right?
Well, we have to be careful between observatory and telescope.
There's okay. All right, tell us the difference.
It's the institution, and we're one institution with two locations. So we've got a bunch of people living in Tucson, Arizona, doing astronomy there. And a bunch of us, I'm one of them, who are in outside of Rome in the Pope's summer home. And that's where I'm speaking from right now, where it's already morning. But in addition, as the observatory, we've got a beautiful telescope in the mountains of Arizona, which we use all the time for the best modern research because it's nice and dark there. And we've got four telescopes here in Rome, but unfortunately the skies here have gotten so bright with the city growing up around them that we can't do a whole lot of serious science with them anymore.
Oh, that's a shame. People would say, why does the Vatican have these telescopes? What are they looking for?
Look, it's the same thing that everybody else is looking for. What's out there? Just to know what's in the sky and to have an idea of how it got to be the way it is. It's the same sense of curiosity and mystery that's fueled people to look at the sky since the beginning of time. You know, I did some time in the Peace Corps 25 years ago, and I brought a little telescope to Africa with me, and we had people in the small villages looking through the telescopes, and they were looking at the rings of Saturn, and they were looking at the moons of Jupiter, and their reaction is exactly the same as yours and mine was, because that's how human beings relate to the universe. If nothing else, it just reminds you that the world is bigger than what's for lunch.
My uncle, who's now no longer with us, you talk about synchronicity of our lives. A long, long time ago in Massachusetts, he sent a letter to Senator John Kennedy recommending that an organization similar to the Peace Corps be established. My uncle was Frederick Baho, and he made a copy of that letter, and we used to look at it all the time. It was an amazing story. Sure was. Now, the Vatican would not be shocked if it were proven that there is intelligent life out there in the universe, would it?
Well, I no more than anybody else would be shocked. It's a kind of a funny thing that, you know, especially with science fiction and everybody watching Star Trek, a lot of people, they think Star Trek is a documentary, that I think we're used to the idea that we're not the only intelligent creatures. But it's all the same universe. It's a big place. And, you know, to quote Carl Sagan, if there wasn't other intelligences out there, it sure would be a waste of space.
Well, it sure would. And I've been a longtime believer of extraterrestrial life out there.
I have to also remind you, though, we don't have the evidence yet, and that's why we keep looking.
Do you want to find it?
Absolutely. It would be so much fun. Plus, it would really be important from a scientific point of view to understand what things are common to life everywhere and what things are unique to life on Earth. Now, imagine if you grew up on an island in the South Seas and all you had was one tree. You'd think that all trees had coconuts. You wouldn't know that there's something different between a pine tree and a palm tree.
That's
right.
And
yet, they're both trees.
And at the same time, the belief in some kind of intelligent life out there would not and should not stop your belief system in a God, right?
And it doesn't. You know, there was a fellow who did some research on this, Ted Peters, a few years ago. He asked people in just about every religion you could come up with, would, you know, discovering intelligent life shake your faith in God? And nobody says that. You know, 90% of the most conservative kind of religious believers say, of course not. And certainly, you know, people who have different ways of interpreting how they would incorporate that into their beliefs. But the important thing is to not jump ahead of yourself and not have your faith depend on there must be people out there, because who knows, maybe we're wrong, maybe we're alone, maybe that tells us something significant too.
Yeah, either way. It sure would be lonely if we were, but what the heck?
It's the old joke that I think Walt Kelly from Pogo had years ago, you know, either there's intelligent life out there, or we're all alone. And either way, it's a sobering thought.
How true. What's new in the world of planetary astronomy? What's happening out there?
Well, the big excitement, of course, are finding planets around other stars. And the Kepler mission has been doing a spectacular job of that. It's so important for us, just as we said, you know, finding life in more than one place. Finding planets around more than one star has told us all sorts of new things about how planetary systems are formed. Half of what I learned when I was a student at MIT, we now know it's not quite the way we thought it was. Just to give you an example.
All right.
When you and I were growing up, We knew that the planets orbited in these nice, stable orbits with stony planets close to the sun and gas giant planets far away. Well, now we're seeing all of these planetary systems where there are gas giant planets close to their star, and who knows what other sorts of planets we're just beginning to discover them at all sorts of other distances, which is beginning to suggest that planets can actually move around from the place where they were formed to the place where we are now. The biggest exciting theory in the last 5 years about the way planets are formed suggests that Neptune and Uranus were formed much closer to Jupiter than they are now, that perturbations actually moved them quite a ways out, stirred up all sorts of other things that caused the great bombardments you see in the craters of the moon, and in the process also captured dwarf planets like Pluto to the orbits that they're in now. It's, you know, completely crazy idea 10 years ago, and now people are saying it seems to work. It seems to explain so much of what we see in our system and in other systems.
Brother Guy, when they talk about Earth-like planets being in the habitable zone, exactly what is that habitable zone?
Well, they're looking for a place where water can be present as a liquid, because basically water is, you know, H2O, everybody knows that. H is the hydrogen, the most common element in the universe. O is oxygen, which is maybe the third or fourth most common. So there ought to be lots of water in the universe compared to any of the other elements. And you'd expect water would be the basis of anything more complicated like life. But it can't be frozen water because it's kind of hard for things to move around. It can't be steam because that's too hot. That kind of breaks apart the, you know, the delicate chemicals of life. So you're looking for liquid water. And so you're looking for a planet that orbits its star at a distance where the temperature on that planet is close to the temperature where water exists as a liquid. Not too hot, not too cold. Some people call it the Goldilocks zone.
The planets that are habitable, you know, they're based on Earth-like. Does that tell you that the formula, the laws of the universe are such that everything should be uniform? It should be the same. So if there's an Earth-like planet and we have liquid water and it exists and it's so close to its sun, that the chances are pretty likely there could be life on those other planets if it's in the same kind of parameter?
Well, that's the big question. You know, if you had lots of places where water was liquid but there was no life, then we'd learn something new about life, that it's a lot harder to get started than we thought.
That's right.
On the other hand, if you could find life even in places where you didn't think it was very likely, then you'd say, well, any place where it's possible, it ought to exist. You know, the old joke comes out of the Sword and the Stone. Remember that book by T.H. White?
Yep.
And in the story, Merlin says to young Wart, you know, in some universes, everything not forbidden is compulsory. And, you know, maybe life is like that. If it's not forbidden, then it's got to be there. Or maybe it turns out that life just needs exactly the right conditions, and if you fail in any one of them, it all falls apart.
Well, see, that's important. You may be right, too. It may be that life has to be so perfect that everything clicks at the same time.
Yeah.
And yet, if it is that perfect, like Earth, then it makes you wonder, why? How? Because I don't think these things are accidents. These things just don't happen by a fluke.
Well, there's accident and there's accident.
Yeah, exactly.
There's this wonderful phrase that a spiritual director once used on me that I love coming back to, which he calls divine coincidence.
If we landed on one of these Earth-like planets, could we probably do so without a spacesuit?
Well, I would guess probably not, simply because we as human beings are pretty delicate. There are places on Earth that life thrives, but human beings have a hard time without some kind of protection. The bottom of the ocean being one obvious place.
Right, right.
Another place would be the kinds of hot springs and very acidic lakes, which nonetheless we find bacteria existing in. So I would suggest any place that you go to, you're probably going to want a suit for just your own protection, and if nothing else, to keep the bugs from out of you and keep your bugs from killing them.
I want to ask you about the Russians' probe. They've been wanting to go to Phobos, one of the moons of Mars. That thing's lost in space somewhere. I don't know what's happening.
They found it, but they can't talk to it.
They can't talk to it anymore. No,
yeah.
That's
right. I think I actually saw some pictures on the internet the other day where they've actually been able to image it with a telescope. They know exactly where it is. What I've been told is that part of the trouble is the fuel tank didn't separate, and that's blocking the radio antenna from signals from the ground.
Can't they project when it's going to come back down?
They can do it. You know, if it doesn't get itself launched, eventually its orbit will decay and it will just burn up in the atmosphere. Yeah,
it should. Why were they going to Phobos?
Oh, interesting point. You know, we're talking about the search for life, and we'd love to know if there's life on Mars, because Mars is, after Earth, sort of the next most habitable kind of place, and certainly the easiest for us to visit. But, you know, what you really want to have is a piece of Mars in your hand that you know where it came from, you know that nothing really horrible has happened to it since you picked it up. We've got meteorites that come from Mars, but, you know, they're blasted off the planet. They've been out of space for 15 million years, so there's not likely to be much life left in them. To get a piece of Mars back to Earth, we can land on Mars, that's easy, but then getting off of Mars and getting back here requires a rocket that, you know, it's like sending half of Cape Canaveral from here all the way to Mars to set up there to build a rocket to come back here.
Yeah.
Tough to do. Well, the Russians have this idea, and they may be right, that the moon of Mars, Phobos, is actually made out of stuff that had been blasted off Mars by impacts and gathered together to form a little moon. Maybe it, instead of that, it's just a captured asteroid, but even if it were just a captured asteroid from someplace else, these other rocks blasted on the surface should have hit Phobos. Well, Phobos is a dinky place. It's about 10 miles across, not even that, 10 kilometers across. So it's got very little gravity. You could land something on Phobos, grab a handful of it, and bring it back to Earth.
I see.
That would be really exciting to be able to do. That's what they wanted to do. But, you know, the probe failed, which happens to about half the probes going to Mars.
If they were able to have gotten there, would they know right away if it was an asteroid or a piece of Mars?
I don't think they would know right away. They would still be arguing about it. I mean, people are arguing about it now, and we've had spacecraft that have gone past Phobos. You really want the sample in your lab to poke and prod and do the chemical measurements to convince yourself one way or the other.
Well, it was a good idea, but it just
maybe the next time, you know, that particular probe didn't work. But we can try again, always try again.
Does the Vatican get involved in any of these kinds of projects?
Well, you know, we don't have the money for our own space program. That's a shame, but the fact of life. But all of us here at the observatory, and there's a dozen of us doing all sorts of different kinds of science, and we're all involved in working with other scientists around the world. So, for instance, this idea of going to Phobos, pick up a sample and coming back, the Russians weren't the only ones to have the idea. I had a colleague who at the time was at Tennessee, is now at the University of Central Florida, who was working on a very similar program and trying to put together a proposal to NASA to send one of these spacecraft. This was all 15 years ago. He's visiting me because we're working together on meteorites as well. He's visiting me here at the Vatican. He's here during the month of April. And during April, of course, that's the week when Easter occurs.
Sure,
and
yeah.
Pope was in residence at the observatory. In those days, our offices were one flight up in the same building as the Pope's apartments. So my friend is on the telephone back to the States, back to some engineers at JPL, and they're yelling at each other because they're not getting each other what they want. And suddenly there's a knock on his door. Guard, and he just puts his finger up to his lips. Suddenly my friend realizes he's one flight up from where the Pope's trying to take a nap.
Keeping the Pope awake. Stay with us, Brother Guy. We're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll talk more with you about God's mechanics and space in general on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, of course, Brother Guy Consolmagno. And he's live in Rome. And we'll be back with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Brother Guy Consolmagno. Brother Guy, why are we so interested in going to asteroids? What are we going to find out? Like the NASA's Dawn mission, what do they want?
Well, asteroids are a lot of fun for a number of reasons. First of all, they're the leftover bits from when the solar system was formed 4.5 billion years ago. Remember, we were growing up and there were housing developments and you'd see all these houses in a row, and in the backyard there'd be the pile of the scraps left over from the house. You could go through the scrap pile and see, oh, these guys have yellow tile in their bathrooms. The asteroid belt is the scrap pile of the solar system. We know what are inside other planets by seeing what's been left over on the outside of the asteroids. Iron metal, for instance. We now know that the most planets have iron-nickel cores because we've got iron-nickel meteorites that come from iron-nickel asteroids. But that's another reason why asteroids are interesting, because you've got these places that are full of minerals like iron and nickel that actually have a tremendous value. Just last month, there was this asteroid with the very sexy name of 2005, YU-55, I think it was.
That's right. And how did they come up with these names, by the way?
Oh, that's just when it was discovered. 2005 was the year it was discovered. Every month is divided into letter A, B, C, D. So the fact that it starts with the letter Y means it was discovered in December. And then U-55 is just, they went through the alphabet for the first 26 they discovered, but now we've got these automated searches, so they discover hundreds every month, so the numbers keep getting bigger at the end. Anyway, if they found this thing, it's on an orbit that actually goes around the sun, but passed by Earth closer to us than the moon. Well, you know, we were able to send people to the moon 50 years ago. So technologically, there's nothing that says if we knew ahead of time what to look for, we couldn't send people to an asteroid. And it's a lot easier to get off an asteroid, just like it was a lot easier to get off of the moon Phobos. You don't have to fight its gravity to get home. You could collect samples that are coming to us from the outer part of the asteroid belt and see what they're made out of. You could also, in some future date, you know, calculate how much material there is. And this asteroid was 400 meters across. Now, that doesn't sound like 200 meters is the radius. 100 meters is about the size of a football field, so 4 football fields across. You know, a shopping mall is bigger than that.
Yeah.
So you got shopping mall-sized asteroid, but you sit down and do the calculation of how much material you've actually got there. You've got $1 trillion worth of iron and nickel and gold and all of the other rare elements, because rather than being sorted out and stuck in the core of a planet, they're just out there for anybody to pick up. Now, to actually go out there and mine it and bring it back would probably also cost you $1 trillion. So it's close to break even at this point. But the day's going to come when it'll be worth doing. And these things are just out there for whoever gets there first to collect them and bring them back.
Wouldn't you think that every heavenly object, like every planet throughout our solar system and beyond our solar system, would all have similar traits because it's all made out of the same primordial soup? So it should all have gold and carbon and everything else?
Well, that's the assumption that we make, and there's a good reason to assume that assumption seems to be correct. You know, how do you tell what something's made out of if it's not in a lab? One of the things they remember to teach you to do in high school chemistry, do you remember they took a little bit of some chemical, you put it on a wire, you put it in a Bunsen burner, and it flashes these different colors?
That's right, and you'd know what it was.
And that way, from the different color, you know what it is. You do it more carefully. It's called a spectrum. Well, stars are really hot places where elements are vapor, and you can tell from the spectra of the stars what elements are there. Different stars do have different compositions, but pretty much it's the same recipe with just minor variations of one or another. We see the same elements in pretty much the same proportions over and over and over everywhere. We've even gotten to the point where we have an idea of how those elements are made, and we can explain it. There's a wonderful word, nucleosynthesis. We can figure out why it's much more common to find iron than it is to find platinum, and platinum more than, say, uranium. And you can even calculate sort of what the different proportions ought to be. And up to now, the calculations are surprisingly good. So we think we've got a handle on what the stuff is that's out there and what the proportions are that you can find it in.
Yeah, I would have to assume that it's the same throughout the universe. That these laws, these uniform laws, they're the same. I mean, I can't comprehend, for example, how one planet could form and have all this stuff, and then another one would form and not have any of it.
Well, and of course, the fun thing is, having said that, and you and I are both in total agreement, this seems to be the reasonable way, nature's going to fool us. We're going to go someplace that will completely boggle our minds, and then we'll go, oops, well, forgot about it.
Exactly.
Then you go back and you change your theory a little bit to take account of the new stuff you discover.
Where's the gold? Where is all this?
And right. You know, gee, there was supposed to be gold. I was promised gold. Fortunately, from the asteroid belt, we do have meteorites there, you know, chunks of iron that, you know, the size of your fist, the size of a football. It would hurt pretty bad if it hit you in the head, but most of the time they miss you. We've got these things that we've seen to fall from the asteroid belt. We can carve them up, we can measure the composition, and we do see, at least in our solar system, exactly the same elements. We even see in some meteorites little pieces of dust that seem to have come from other nearby stars. So at least in our local neighborhood, it all looks to be made out of the same kind of stuff.
Where, Brother Guy, do you think life occurred on this planet? Did it come from a comet? Did it come from some other source? Or was it always here on the planet when it was formed?
You know, we don't know. And I know people who are looking into this whole question scientifically who would argue all of the above. You know, you got people arguing from one idea or from the other idea. We just plain don't know. It seems reasonable to think that we're in this beautiful planet that has all the ingredients we need for life, and it was just the chemistry was allowed to become complicated enough that life could form, but we don't know how that happened. And there are holes in our understanding of the chemistry of how you go from amino acids to something that actually is crawling on the ground that, you know, we haven't figured out yet. Maybe 100 years from now, we'll realize that was the easy part and the hard part was some other thing we haven't even realized we don't know yet. We don't know. Still, you have to make a guess. You have to say to yourself, I don't know, but I'll bet you it's over here and that's where I'm going to spend the next 2 years of my life doing research. And the guys guess right, guys or gals, they're the ones who wind up with the Nobel Prizes.
They do. And where do you, this, is this tough for you in that? You're a scientist, you know, you've got a PhD, yet you're also a Jesuit. Most scientists that I've interviewed, Brother Guy, don't believe in God. They don't believe in a higher intelligence. They don't even go there. I would assume you do. You have to. Have you been at odds with yourself because of science and because of your belief system?
It's a funny thing. You know, I always was Catholic. I was always a churchgoer. I never made a big deal of it. Just kind of part of my life, part of my background, part of being half Italian, half Irish, you know.
Yeah. Oh, you had it then, yeah.
And it just kind of the way I grew up. So these, you know, who taught me the science? It was the nuns at Queen of Martyrs grade school where I grew up in Birmingham, Michigan. But when I became a Jesuit, this was the first time I sort of came out publicly as a churchgoer. And like you, I had assumed, well, most of my fellow scientists, we don't talk about religion, obviously must not be something. Over and over and over again, I go to people who I had known for years and say, you're a Jesuit now. Let me tell you about the church I belong to. And I'm thinking, belong to a church? I never realized that. Well, you sure don't act like it.
Yeah, exactly.
But in fact, I find that the scientists, at least the astronomers I've met, proportional, the number of them who tend to go to church pretty much matches whatever culture they're coming from. You know, more Americans go to church than Englishmen, for instance, just for whatever reason. And more American scientists are churchgoers than British scientists, just, you know, the cultural background. And you'll find every religion, religions you would never have thought of, religions that are seem to be hostile to science until you realize there are a lot of scientists who belong to those religions. And then you ask yourself, okay, how do they make it work? How do they answer those questions? It's kind of interesting because to me it seems easy as a Catholic. The Catholics are not a religion that says it's only the Bible and the Bible is literally true. We've never been like that. You know, Thomas Aquinas doesn't say that. St. Augustine didn't say that 1,500 years ago. He argued strongly against that way of interpreting the Bible. So we're pretty easy to be able to say, God made the universe, let's pay attention to the way he actually made it, not the way we think he should have made it. But then you run into people who belong to other religions that have a little more restricted view of the world, and yet they're very good scientists, and they're very interested in this sort of thing. The fellow who headed the Human Genome Project, Francis Collins, is an evangelical Christian, far more conservative in his beliefs than I am, and frankly, a far better scientist than I am, too. So it's possible to have this wide range of beliefs, but you carry these beliefs with you, not only, you know, something that you do with on Sunday, but something that motivates, why am I interested in studying the universe? You know, there's a bigger question behind, why does the Vatican support an astronomical observatory? Is it to get rich? Is it to get famous? Is it to get your name in the paper? Is it to win a Nobel Prize? A lot of people go into science for those reasons. You know, they think it's going to, you know, get them girls or something. I don't know. That sure didn't work for me. But why do we do science? Day to day, what gets you up and going into the lab? Being a scientist is really hard, not because you have to know a lot of math or know a lot of physics, because after you've learned it, you've learned it. It's hard because it's a very slow, sometimes tedious kind of day-to-day work, and it's only after years of work that you can finally say, okay, this is what I've learned, and I'm pretty confident of it. So what motivates you to do that day-to-day, in and out? And for me, as a religious person, it's that sense that I'm touching the stuff that God made, and that day in and day out, seeing how the universe works, I'm in a conversation with the Creator. And to me, that's what motivates my way of doing science. So I don't know that I would be a scientist without having a belief in God.
And will you always believe this?
I'm sure my beliefs will always grow, just as a couple who have been married 50 years know each other a whole lot better than newlyweds do. Yet you hope that they stay in love all that time, and the love grows and deepens.
You do hope that's absolutely true. Have you ever been at odds with your belief system? Have you ever fought yourself over it?
I've never run into it that way. You know, the big crises in my life were not a crisis of faith with my religion. I'm comfortable with my religion. I'm comfortable with the fact that we're flawed human beings who actually do a much better job than you would expect, given the fact that we're flawed human beings when it comes to the religion thing. The places that I've had problems have been when I've encountered scientists who didn't play by the rules, who right. faked their data, who stole ideas from other people, who acted in reprehensible ways. And I would shake my head and say, why am I putting up with these people? Why do I want to work with these people? And on occasion, when I look back at something I've done myself and I go, maybe I'm not living up to my own standards there either. It's dealing with human frailty and human fallibility. It's why science needs to work as a community to correct each other, why we give our papers to each other to review, because we know we're never going to be always right. And it can be discouraging at times when you see people getting it wrong, when you see people acting in a dishonorable way in science. That was why I joined the Peace Corps. I was fed up at one point with what shenanigans I thought I saw going on in my field. And so I thought, well, I'll give it up. I'll just go and, you know, do some good for some people elsewhere. And that's when I found out that the Africans wanted to know about astronomy just as much as my friends at home. They reminded me that I'm not doing it for the glory or for the credit, but for the future joy of it, for that sense of wow you get when you see the rings of Saturn at the telescope.
That's right.
And when I had that experience, I came back to the people who I thought were doing me wrong, and I realized I was maybe being unjust to them, that we had honest disagreements, and they weren't nasty, and they weren't evil. They were just had an honest disagreement about what we were coming up with and maybe who should get credit for it. Some of these people who I thought of as my enemies back then are colleagues that I work with all the time now and consider friends today.
Is it possible, as we look into the things in the heavens, that one day science will truly get the answers that we've been seeking about, and I want to talk with you about the Big Bang next hour, but will they get the answers? Because it seems to me, Brother Guy, that we still don't really have answers for many things. we discover things. We find planets. We find black holes. We find systems. But we still don't know why or how.
Yes. This is a wonderful thing about being a Jesuit. They made me take philosophy classes. And one thing that a philosophy professor taught me, which just really hit me, he says, there's two kinds of questions where you're looking for answers. One would be, it's Christmas time. Somebody hands you a Christmas present. And your question is, what's in the box? Well, you open the box and you find out what's in the box, and that question has been answered. And there's never ever going to be a different answer to it. That answer is done. It's now a boring question. The other question is, why did that person give me the present?
That's right.
And that's not a box you can open up and find a simple answer. That's something about the relationship that you have with that person that's going to grow, that's going to change, and you're always going to be asking that question, and you're always going to be having, well, it's because, you know, he's my brother, he's supposed to. Well, he's my brother, and we love each other. Well, he's my brother, and we've been through these things together. And those answers keep getting deeper and keep getting richer without ever being solved, like the question of what was in the box in the first place. There are questions that science is going to answer, like what's in the box. And there are questions that science is really good at posing, but you need philosophers to remind you there's never going to be a final answer to them.
No, there never will be. There never will be at all. You know, coming up on Christmas, you know, one of the great astronomical stories of all times, the Star of Bethlehem, what was it?
Well, you know, when I became a Jesuit and assigned to the Vatican, I figured I'm going to be asked this, right? Everybody sees Vatican.
Everybody will ask you that.
You know, right. And they all love the Star of Bethlehem stories. So I did a lot of reading about it, and I've read lots of books, and there are lots of theories out there. They're all great theories. They've all got wonderful explanations, and they're all different. There isn't any one answer that everybody agrees on. That's, oh, it must have been this, or oh, it must have been that. I'll give you three answers that are all appealing to me in different ways.
Okay.
There's a guy named Michael Molnar wrote a book originally called The Star of Bethlehem. Hard to forget that. There's a lot of books out there with that title. He says, when they're talking about the star in the east, what they're really talking about are a collection of planets rising with the sun. And that's why the astrologers could know that there was this event going on, but the people in Jerusalem never saw it.
Uh-huh.
And, the ancient astrologers 2,000 years ago would say, if you have all these planets rising with the sun, that's evidence of a king. After all, Caesar Augustus used a similar kind of conjunction of planets and sun. So, did anything like that occur around the time when Jesus was born? Yeah, actually, he found a pretty impressive collection of planets rising with the sun in April of around, I think it's 4 BC. You can go to a planetarium program that you get online, or, you know, Starry Night or Voyager or one of those programs, and look for yourself and see, sure enough, there's all these planets rising with the sun.
It'll show you exactly what it was like.
What it was like, and you say, aha, that was the Star of Bethlehem. Well, there's another book called The Star of Bethlehem, written by a guy at the planetarium, the Griffith Planetarium in Los Angeles, who says, no, what we've got are a conjunction of planets right next to a star in Leo the Lion, and that would be the symbol of the Lion of Judah, and that would be the symbol of a king, and he shows when that happened. Also, just before that, you know, very convincing and very unusual and very impressive.
How do you know who's right? Brother Guy, we're gonna take this break. Just stay right there. We will come right back. Brother Guy is live at the Vatican in Rome, and we will be right back on Coast to Coast AM.